All right, so we are picking up in Joshua. So just quick, really brief review. Okay, so we started Joshua last time. Went through kind of those first two main points of Joshua, the kind of entering the land and conquering the land. And if you remember, the theme of Joshua was the God who conquers. And so again, we start this, like we talked about, like this conquest theology that kind of begins here with the conquest of Joshua's day, but it's going to be finalized in the final conquest of Christ later on. That's still future even to today. So even Revelation 19 talks about that. But we're starting it. And so if you remember last time, they are now in the land. They crossed the Jordan, entered, and they started conquering. And so we went through kind of our three campaigns. Do you guys remember kind of the order of it?
Middle,
south, and then north, right? And so remember that kind of the punch of the gut, kick to the knees, uppercut, right? Finish them off. So yeah, so that's kind of the order, okay? And so we kind of went through some of that, hit some of the highlights of some of the main things. But we kind of really dealt with the conquest proper, okay? Kind of that main conquest that we saw in Joshua. And so now we're getting into kind of the more establishing and getting them more established in the land. And so we're at like our third kind of division of the book here, which is dividing the land. Okay, this is where they kind of apportion out the land to all the various tribes. Okay, is kind of what's going on in this section. And so we'll go through this kind of quick because we're not going to like read through in this city connects to this city. And yeah, that's all right. You can draw your map and stuff another time, but we'll just kind of go through kind of quick with this. But kind of the main idea of this section, if we're just boiling down this section where they're again establishing all the tribes and the cities and all that, is that God is really establishing his nation to make an international impact. Okay, God is establishing his nation to make an international impact. And so we saw that before, like even in the Torah, in that study where we saw that God was doing things not just to put himself on display to Israel, but also to the nations. But really what we saw is God's going to establish the nation of Israel so that they be a light to the nations, so that his name would be declared to the nations, okay? And so God here is establishing them to make this international impact, okay? All right, and so as he does this, so God is going to put the nation, the tribes in their various places, all that. Some of it will tie back into some of like the prophecies of like Genesis 49 or Deuteronomy 33, where God had different kind of roles for some of the tribes. Some of that's going to tie in here. And so that's kind of at work. But then also you'll keep in mind that throughout all this, Israel is still going to fail. Okay, they're going to fail to do this. And that's why we talked about that Joshua actually continues to look towards the future when the conquest will be accomplished. It'll be completed, okay? And so that's where we start, chapter 13. So that's where we're picking up, and we start with this aspect of land still to be conquered. So those first seven verses in chapter 13 is just laying out what we've kind of already confirmed before, but further confirmation that Israel kind of failed in completely conquering the land. Right, they did not go to the far lengths of where they should have gone. And then we'll see some of those kind of consequences come back to kind of bite them here. But what this passage shows, it goes beyond. Remember last time we talked about the Gibeonites, how they kind of deceived Israel, all that. And that was kind of where they initially already kind of failed, because now they can't drive them out of the land. But we're going to see that in these verses, there is even more, okay, that they did not do, okay? All right, and then you see kind of next part of chapter 13, last part is just the division of the land to the east of the Jordan. So if you remember, there's the 2.5 tribes that wanted to settle on the east side of the Jordan River. So you have like the tribe of Reuben and Gad, and then half of Manasseh all wanted to settle over there. And so this kind of details those three get, or 2.5 getting their inheritances. Okay, so again, the land that was promised to them. Then the beginning of chapter 14 just kind of introduces this concept. They're going to start dividing the land. And then a kind of important part here, we have the inheritance of Caleb. Okay, and if we get this inheritance of Caleb. And you guys remember who Caleb is? Oh, yeah. Yeah, you, yeah. That's right. Yeah, back there. Yeah. Yeah. So you guys remember who Caleb is? Yeah, one of the two spies that went in, the original 12 spies, right? And one of the two that came back with the good report, that actually trusted God and all that. And so we see here, he is getting his inheritance, which is going to be like in the land of like Hebron and everything. And it's interesting because if you look at his kind of what he's inheriting, it talks about he's kind of inheriting like the land of like the giants, right, essentially. And which is totally fitting, because if you remember when like the 12 spies went into the land, and you remember like the report of like the spies that did not want to trust God and all that, what do they say? They're like giants. Like, we can't compete with these people, and like, we're just going to die. They're going to kill our kids, all this stuff. And what, Caleb was the one that's like, what are you talking about? We got this. Like, it doesn't matter what they are. Like, we got God on our side. We're good. Let's go take the land. I want the land. Let's go, right? And so it's so fitting that now in chapter 14, that's his inheritance, right? It's like, yeah, go up and get that land. And he's like, all right, I'll go get it, right? And so you see that Caleb was what? Right to trust the Lord. Okay, he was right to trust the Lord. And so his inheritance is so fitting to all that, right? It kind of comes full circle with that. All right, and then in chapter 15, you have the inheritance of Judah given here. And so they come first, which kind of makes sense, because what are they the tribe of? Yeah, the kings, right? They're the royal tribe. And so they get to kind of go first. It kind of makes sense. They are often the leader. They're depicted as this leader. And so they get the kind of first dibs here. They get kind of their land all allotted out. However, you also have, even with them, right, the tribe of the kings and all that, verse 63 talks about how they did not still get all the people out of the land, right? The Jebusites remained in Jerusalem. The people of Judah could not drive them out. And so the Jebusites dwelled the people to this day. Okay, so again, you see that element. They still fail to fully capture the land. Okay, and we're going to see even more of that, even from the tribe of Judah later on. Okay, all right. And then you have the inheritances of Ephraim and the other half of Manasseh. And so, again, kind of these two major tribes, right, are these kind of three, like the Ephraim, Manasseh, the sons of Joseph, okay? So one of the main people you'd expect their tribes to be kind of big and all that, as well as like Judah on the other side, right? So those are the two that get these lands kind of portioned out. And so now you have Ephraim and Manasseh getting their land, and kind of the same thing happens with these tribes. They get their land, but they fail to fully conquer, all right? They fail to fully drive out all the people from the land. One cool side note in here is you see, if you remember back from the book of Numbers, Zelophehad's daughters, remember, they kind of came and they're like, hey, we want to make sure we have a portion in the land. And everything, and it showed that desire of the tribe of Manasseh, like that they really wanted to enter the land, contrary to the old generation that kind of was like, yeah, we can't enter the land because they're going to kill us, all this stuff, right? And that stood contrast to the new generation that was like, we're going in, we want it. And those daughters were kind of a symbol of that, of kind of like, we want our inheritance, right? And so you see that unfolding here, all right? They received their land, the Lord is faithful and all that, right? Okay, but again, they still fail to conquer. And then in the next couple chapters, you see the inheritance of the remaining tribes. So again, this all unfolds, kind of cast their lots, do all these things to determine their allotments. And so now you have them sort of settled in the land. Okay, everyone has their spots, all that. But again, they haven't fully completed the conquest. And so you're left with this tension that God is continuing to move his plan forward, but Israel keeps kind of failing, okay? But despite that failing, God's going to keep moving the plan forward, okay? But you have that tension. All right, and then you also have at the end of chapter 19, you have the inheritance of Joshua. So not only did Caleb get his inheritance, so did Joshua. Again, one of the faithful two spies gets his land as well. Okay. And then in chapter 20, you have the cities of refuge. They are established. So again, this is connecting back into the Torah, what we talked about before in the fall. We have these cities of refuge that God established that were designed to like kind of protect people. Okay, where those were like the cities that like if you were, I don't know, like cutting a tree or something with your axe and then your axe blade flew off and like killed someone. Like obviously didn't mean to do it. And so it was an accident. But this was a place, these were the places you would like kind of go to kind of let them then figure it all out before the family member comes and like, well, you killed my brother, I'm going to kill you, right? Like, so you're going to run to these to like get to let them kind of figure out like, yeah, you didn't do it on purpose, all that, it's all good, right? Okay, so, but again, so these are now established and we see God's mercy in this and like his desire to protect life, right? Like that's his desire in all of this, okay? And then chapter 21, we have the Levitical cities given. And so if you remember, the Levites were not given a specific land for their tribe, but instead they were to be scattered throughout all the other tribes. Okay, they were to be scattered throughout the land in their various cities was kind of that their purpose here. And the purpose behind that was it allowed them to minister to all the various tribes. Okay, so the Levites were part of the priests and all that, right? Like, and so it allowed them to minister to all the various tribes and the people of Israel. And really, it was to help kind of cultivate this life of worship in Israel. That's really the job of the Levites, was to help Israel as a nation cultivate this life of worship. That's their goal. Okay, and so that's why they're kind of scattered about in all the various tribes to accomplish this purpose. Okay. All right, so the land is settled. They can be a nation who worships and points people back to God. That's really their role. And then we see these kind of last few chapters here of Joshua, where what we're going to see kind of unfold is some kind of fractures start to form here. Okay, where Joshua, there will be a little bit of some good things that it ends on, but there's also some kind of not the highest notes that Joshua is ending on here. Okay, and we're going to see some events that happen that show, again, this kind of fracturing in the nation that eventually is going to lead to like a full-on crisis. So Joshua does not end at that crisis, but you kind of start to see some things. You're like, oh, that's interesting. That might come like rear its head again someday, right? And so that's what you see kind of unfolding here. And the first kind of fracture that we start seeing is recorded in chapter 22, which we see kind of titled here like Civil War Averted. So if you remember, this is when they kind of finished the allotments of land, all that, and then the eastern tribes, the ones that settled on the east side of the Jordan, so like Reuben, Gad, half of Manasseh, they start returning home. They go back to their land and everything. And do you remember what they did when they crossed back over? What was the first thing they kind of did? They built an altar. And do you remember the response of like all the tribes on the west of the Jordan? Were they like, yeah, that's awesome? No, they're like kind of, what are you doing? We're going to come attack you and kill all you, right? Like, this kind of thing, like, wow, that seems intense. That seems rather drastic of a response. But what did they kind of assume they were doing, right? That they were, this was like a step into idolatry, okay? That this was a step into idolatry. You're building this altar. What are you kind of doing, right? Because in Israel's, like, in their law and different things, they were big on, they were supposed to worship in one place, kind of like together. Okay, that was what they're big on, because they have one God, and so they're celebrating that fact. And so, yeah, there you can worship privately, all these things, but primarily it was about like gathering together at like one place of worship together, okay? And like at the tabernacle, or later on at like the temple, like things like this. And so these tribes now building this other altar to the other western tribes are like, hey, that's not okay. This looks a lot like idolatry, which according to like Deuteronomy 13, it talks about like, hey, if a city is going down the path of idolatry, you kind of wipe them out. And so they're doing this. They're like, we're ready, let's go. And what? the Eastern tribes kind of clarify, like, hey, we didn't build this altar to worship on. We just built this as kind of like a witness to kind of testify that we're actually part of the people of Israel. Right? That's what they're saying. That's why we built this altar. We're not trying to worship on it. It's just this witness that we're part of Israel and all that. Okay? And this explanation, it satisfies the other tribes. So kind of this full-on civil war is kind of averted. Okay? So kind of crisis averted here a little bit. But even in this account, you start to see some of these fractures that are forming in the nation. Right? You see these fractures. So first off, right, like you see these tribes, like these 2.5 tribes, they do something kind of sketchy, right? And on the surface, looks like idolatry to where the other tribes freak out about it. So not the best thing to do. And they do this to make a point, but they're kind of doing it by weird means. And so this may actually start opening that door to actual idolatry being more easily adopted later on, right? Like as we'll see later today. But another thing where you start to see this fracturing is what does this really say that if on the first day back to like they go back to their land, that first day they're getting back, they feel like they're so disconnected that they need to build this altar to say, hey, we're actually part of the people of Israel, right? You start to see the relationship has already started like a little fractured and damaged, right? That they feel like, oh man, we have to build something so that we don't get left out, right? Like that the other tribes don't say, oh, you don't belong to us, okay? So you start to see like, yeah, something is off here. This isn't good. And so really, this is preparing us for some of the more difficult crises that are going to unfold later on, okay? That we'll see more of this kind of disunity, but you can kind of start to see the cracks in the armor here, okay? All right, and then in chapter 23, Joshua's farewell exhortation, so, or even, and this one, he has a couple things, but this one, is focused primarily on the leadership of Israel, okay? So he kind of gathers the leadership, gives kind of a final charge here to them to essentially like finish the job, finish the conquest, keep it going, do all this, okay? And verse 14 is cool because notice in this, look what he says. He says, "And now I'm about to go to the way of all the earth, and you know in your hearts and souls, all of you, that not one word has failed of all the good things that the Lord your God promised concerning you. All have come to pass for you. Not one of them has failed." Okay? I love that, right? He emphasizes to the leadership, like reminds them of God's faithfulness. He's been faithful down to the very word. Not one of his word has failed. This is your God, right? Like, so you in return, like, be faithful, right? Like, and again, that should give us comfort even for us today, right? This is still our God. That he is faithful down to the very word, okay? And so he encourages them to continue on. And while this is good, right, like, and you keep, in a, sorry, when we go, talk about God's faithfulness, and when he talks about this, God is faithful down to the very word, that's encouraging, right? On the one side, that's very encouraging for, like, the good things, but also, what does that mean? God's going to also be faithful to what? Like, the judgment. Like if you remember Deuteronomy 28, the blessings and the what? Curses. So God will be faithful to all of it. Okay? It's not like he's only going to be faithful to the good stuff, but he's also going to be faithful to like if you disobey, he's coming for you, right? Like he's doing it, right? He's not going to let that slide. And so they have to understand that. But it is interesting, and some people kind of bring up like it is interesting that Joshua even has to have this kind of encouragement for like the leadership that might indicate again that there might be some fracturing the leadership already, right? The fact that they need to be encouraged to do some of these things, they should have already been doing it, right? Like they should have been pushing forward in the conquest. They shouldn't have stopped. They should be continually moving forward. But the fact that they need Joshua's further encouragement might be an indication that again, there's now some fracturing in the leadership as well, okay? Not just the nation. All right. And that takes us into our last chapter, chapter 24, and we see another covenant renewal at Shechem. So we saw that kind of before in Joshua when they first entered the land, kind of did a covenant renewal here at Shechem, which was a big deal because if you remember, that's where like God promised Abraham that, hey, this is going to be the land given to your descendants, and that's a huge thing. And so again, they come back to the same place and kind of go through this again. And this is... And so this is with all the people, not just the leadership this time. This is with all the people. And this is where Joshua calls them to serve the Lord faithfully. Okay, and this is where you have that famous passage that often gets like put in the houses, all that, right? Like, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord, right? That kind of famous thing. But what's interesting about like that verse, the context of that, if you notice like the beginning of that verse, it says in 24:15, that's where it is. It says, "And if it is evil in your eyes to serve the Lord, choose this day whom you will serve, whether the gods of your fathers served in the region beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord," right? It's interesting because we often think of this of like, yeah, who are you going to choose to serve, the Lord or other gods? But what's he actually say in this verse? It's like, you're already almost like choosing not to serve God, so choose who you're going to serve. Like, you want the false gods of like beyond the Jordan, you want the false gods of Amorites, who are you going to choose to serve, right? If you're going to reject God. And so, again, there's that emphasis on that. But, he says, but for me, like, we're going to serve the Lord. And then notice the response of people in verse 16. What? They say, "Far be it from us that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods." Like, we're not going to do that. We'll be faithful. We're going to serve. We're going to do it. But then, kind of funny, verse 19, what's Joshua's response to that? What's he saying in verse 19? Yeah, you're not able to. He's like, you're not able to serve the Lord, for he is holy. Okay, so it's almost like they're like, no, we're going to do it. He's like, you're not able to, okay? And all that. And so, and then they still reaffirm it. They're like, no, we're going to do it. And he's like, all right, like, this is kind of bearing witness that you will serve the Lord and all that, okay? But again, you start to see this reality that even Joshua recognizes the nation, like, they can't do it. Right? They might want to, like someone might actually want to serve the Lord, but they're not going to be able to do it because God is a holy God and they're not going to be able to stand before him. And so that's what's happening. Okay. And so we see there's this fracturing, not only in the leadership, but also in the people themselves. Okay. And we'll see that much more compounded in the book of Judges in a moment here. All right. But even though there is some fracturing kind of in the nation, Joshua tells us, like in, let's see, whatever, verse 31, it says, like, Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua and had known all the work that the Lord did for Israel. So it does end on that good note of, okay, like the people while Joshua's alive, while like the other elders are alive, like that were with Joshua, that leadership, the people served the Lord. They served Yahweh. They really sought to serve him. They were faithful to that, right? They said, yeah, we want to serve the Lord, and they're doing it, okay? They're striving for that. But what do you start to see in chapter 24, or these last few verses? What starts happening? If you're looking at some of those. What's kind of recorded in some of these verses, if you're just kind of glancing over these? Like, what's happening in these, like, last four verses or so? What are some of the major things that are kind of happening here? Yeah, people are dying, right? And specifically, you have what? Like, Joshua dies, and then you have, like, Eleazar, one of the the high priest, dies. And so you're having that leadership start dying off. Okay, and so you have them, like, you have that statement, like, yeah, while Joshua's alive and all the elders who outlived him, like, while they were alive, Israel was serving the Lord, being faithful. But then chapter 24 ends on also, like, but they're dying, right? Like, that leadership is dying. And so the question is, like, will Israel remain faithful? Are they going to continue? After this leadership starts to die off, will the next generation, will all these people remain faithful to the Lord? Okay? And that's where we're going to turn to Judges. But real quick, before we do, also notice in there, just this random tidbit, verse 32, it talks about like the bones of Joseph being buried and stuff. And you might think, well, that's random. That's weird, right? But if you remember at the end of Genesis, back in our study there, when Joseph, before he dies and all that, he tells like his brothers all that to swear like, hey, when you guys leave this land and God is faithful to bring you out and he brings you in the promised land, bring my bones with you and bury them there, right? And it was kind of that idea that, like, yeah, it's going to happen, right? God is going to be faithful. It's going to happen. And what we see here is just this little emphasis of Joseph's bones being buried is like, what? God's plan is still on track. God's plan is still moving forward. He has been faithful. He's continuing that. He has done it. Okay? All right. So that wraps up Joshua. And so we have the question, how will this nation do once this leadership starts dying off? And that takes us into Judges. Okay? Just any questions before we move on? Anything real quick? Sweet. All right, so kind of our introduction to Judges here. We'll kind of work through some of the same things, get some background going. So title of the book, Judges, okay? There you go. So again, I'm sure you can guess why it's called Judges from some of the main characters of the book. We're going to see these people called the Judges. Even though, as I've referenced before, who's the ultimate main character? Not quite. Of every book of the Bible, who's the main character? God, right? Yeah, God is the main character. All right. And so from our, like, humanly speaking, we think of, like, the judges as the main characters, but we have to also keep in mind who's the ultimate. It's God, right? God is the main character. He's the one. But on, like, a human level, these judges are kind of the most prevalent throughout the book, so that's why we have this title. Okay, that's, again, similar in the Hebrew as well. Okay? But we should also clarify this term judge. Okay, that we see throughout the book is not like maybe what comes to our mind when we think of judge. We think of like rendering the verdict, right? Like all that. But we think of like the courtroom, everything. But when we talk about judge, like that Hebrew term has more the idea of a deliverer. Okay, a deliverer. And that's really their function throughout Judges. They're not just sitting around doing some court cases, right? Like judging the people in that way. But rather, it is God's raising up these people to deliver his people. Okay, so it's these individuals that God raises up to deliver his people, and they often actually function more like kind of like military leaders rather than like judicial judges. Okay, so just to kind of clarify that. Okay? All right, authorship. Who wrote Judges? And we don't know exactly, okay? The text doesn't give us that. We have some speculations. And so just like Joshua, we have some like kind of traditional kind of thoughts. And so one of the main traditions is that Samuel wrote it. Okay, so Samuel, which we'll see more in 1 Samuel and all that coming up here. But Samuel might have been the one to write it since he would have been towards like the end of the Judges. He's the last judge. Everything actually, and all that, okay? And so, as we're going to talk about in a moment, like the events in this book kind of depict things that happen over hundreds of years, okay? So, probably not one person who lived through all of it. And so, it kind of makes sense that someone compiling this afterwards, okay? Probably shortly after these accounts have been written, okay? And so, whether it was Samuel or not, kind of his time frame makes sense, okay, for a couple reasons, and some of those reasons tie into our date, okay? So when was this written? Again, we can't give exact dates because we don't know who wrote it, right, kind of a thing. But again, as we kind of talked with Joshua, there's a little bit of overlap here. There seems to be a reason that this would have been written before the monarchy of Israel was established, so before the time of King Saul. Before he reigns, okay? There are some reasons why this would make sense. And again, similar ones that we talked with Joshua, there's again references to the Jebusites being in Jerusalem till this day. So as the time of the writing, they're saying the Jebusites are there, which we talked about last time. Who ended up getting the Jebusites all out of Jerusalem for good? Remember who does that? One of the kings. One of the most famous ones. David. So King David, all right? So likely then written before the time of King David, okay? And then you also have references to like Canaanites living in Gezer to this day, which during the time of Solomon, Gezer gets like wiped out. All the Canaanites are killed by Pharaoh in order to give Gezer to Solomon as like a gift, okay? So likely written before that as well. So before a lot of the monarchy and all that. So it indicates kind of this earlier writing. But then another thing that makes sense before the monarchy is, do you remember kind of the repeated phrase throughout Judges? There was no what in Israel? King, right? There's no king in Israel. Okay? And then everyone did what was right in their own eyes, right? Like all that. So there's that emphasis there. So it seems more likely that this was written before the monarchy. Saul began reigning in like 1051 BC. And so sometime before that. So Samuel would fit that if you like that. But we just don't know for sure. All right. Okay, historical context. So getting, again, a little bit of background as we come into the book of Judges. And we'll get some dates kind of coming here. So if you remember our kind of dates for the conquest in general, all right, kind of that main portion of the conquest, that seven-year period, 1406 to 1399 BC, that was what we held for that main portion of the conquest. But if you remember, after the conquest, you have that period where they kind of continue some of the conquest. We have Joshua still there. Other leaders are still alive, and they're serving the Lord, as we just talked about. And so we don't know exactly how long that period lasted, but one historian kind of dated this transition from Joshua to the time of the judges to where the judges would start around 1350 BC. Okay, so it gives kind of like a 49, 50-year almost kind of gap, okay, where that would be kind of living out the days of Joshua, living out the days of the other elders where they're serving the Lord before the events of the judges start to kind of take place here, okay? And if you remember what I just mentioned, King Saul kind of takes the throne at 1051 BC. So then this kind of period of the judges would be this 1350 to 1051 BC, somewhere around there, okay? So roughly about like at least 300 years of a time period. That's what we're going to be covering, okay, during the time of the judges. That's how much they reign, 300 years. But it's interesting, if you actually go through the book of Judges and you kind of add up all the like 10 years of the judges of like, okay, well, how long were people oppressed for? Then the judge came and did stuff, and then they had rest for this many years, all that. And you actually end up with well over like 400 years. Okay, so you're like, well, how's that work? 400 into 300? And what we're going to see is the most likely kind of explanation for that is that there's some overlap. Okay, there's some overlap. That you might have some various judges kind of functioning at the same time. Because as we're going to talk about, they didn't have an easy time rallying the whole nation of Israel behind them. And so what you probably had was judges functioning in specific parts of Israel at a time. Okay, so you could end up dealing with multiple kind of nations attacking, but at different parts. Okay, does that make sense? And it could even be in those times of rest for certain parts, then another part of Israel is getting kind of oppressed by a different nation. Okay, does that make sense? So that's kind of what it condenses in, all right? Okay, let's see. So keep that in mind. Other historical context, if you remember with Joshua, we talked about how there was kind of a big power vacuum in the land of Canaan during that time, that a lot of the major powers of that day were kind of preoccupied with other stuff. And so then that kind of left the land of Canaan wide open for Israel to kind of come on through, and they just had to deal with kind of the smaller peoples and nations. And that kind of largely continued through the time of the judges, okay? That largely continued through the time of the judges, where you had, again, like some of the bigger powers, like, for example, like Assyria and the Hittites. They were, again, preoccupied kind of with themselves, of they were overly concerned about, like, each other, and so they didn't really want to venture much south into the land of Canaan. And even the Hittites were weakening during that time, where around 1200 BC, they actually, like, are destroyed, okay, by the Sea Peoples. That we'll talk about a little bit later. And then you still had Egypt, all right? If you remember, they were also like during the conquest and especially during the beginning of the judges period, they were very internally focused. You had a pharaoh that really liked the arts and stuff and didn't really want to go to wars and all that. And then you had another guy that followed after him of like really big on like, I'm going to build like this, my own religion thing and really focus on that. And we're not going to worry about wars and all that. And we saw that evidenced by, remember we talked about like the Armana letters. That was these letters of correspondence between some of the Canaanite kings in Egypt of like asking for help. They're getting destroyed. Help us out. And Egypt's kind of like, yeah, got to go paint a picture or something, right? Like, busy, all right? So we kind of have that. So it leads to this power vacuum. And there's a few exceptions, as we'll see in Judges. So during this time, like Egypt, later pharaohs do kind of move in, and there's some exceptions, but largely it's a kind of power vacuum still during this time, okay? All right, and so kind of, again, with these bigger major powers kind of preoccupied, they just had to deal with kind of the smaller people, okay? And so one of my professors, I'll use the example of kind of the schoolyard bullies, right? Kind of a thing where you might have some, if you're like, think of a bunch of like second graders or something, you might have within the second graders, there's like the big kids. They're kind of the bullies, like they kind of pick on people. But then they pick on people until what, like the fifth graders come along, and then they pick on everyone, right? Those bullies don't look like bullies anymore. But when the fifth graders are gone, then you have the small bullies, right? And so that's what you kind of have with Judges, is a lot of these kind of small bullies kind of picking on Israel and everything. And so that's where you have a focus more on the nations like the Philistines, the Moabites, the Ammonites, Midianites, Canaanites. Like, that's really what the focus is on in the book of Judges, not as much the big powerhouse people like Egypt, Assyria, like kind of those things, okay? All right. And then, again, significantly, I just mentioned like the Philistines, okay? We saw them referenced in the Torah briefly, but really in the book of Judges, and then going on into like 1st, 2nd Samuel, we see they become one of the main foes of Israel, okay? And they seem to be connected with the sea people that I mentioned that kind of took out like the Hittites and all that before. And they end up settling on like the coastal plains of Israel. Okay, and so again, you see one of the consequences of Israel not completing the conquest. That what? There should have been people there. In fact, like Judah should have been there, right? That was one of their areas. They should have conquered all the way to the coast, had it locked down, but what? No one was there, and so these people, all right, we'll just settle here. And so the Philistines kind of move in, and they become kind of this thorn in the side of Israel for a long time, okay? So we see the consequences unfolding. All right, and then the last piece of his historical context, just to kind of keep in mind here, is, again, we're going back to those Armana letters, which, again, was that correspondence between someone like the Canaanite kings and all that in Egypt. And just I want to point it out, which is interesting in this, they date to this time, but you get a glimpse into what Israel was like that during that time, a little glimpse in the land of Canaan. And what you have, like, for example, there was one of them talks about how there's this king that's like in like a more northern kingdom, like above the land of Canaan, that needs to go down to Egypt for some business. And he's writing to the Pharaoh to essentially, hey, can you send me a military escort to bring me through the land? Because it was so bad, right, that he didn't feel safe passing through the land, right? That's how bad it was in the land of Canaan, right? Was that this guy is like, I don't feel safe. I need a military escort to get me through. And you're going to see that unfold in Judges as well, of people kind of traveling through. Doesn't always end well, even for Israelites, right? Like, and so we'll see some bad things happen, especially towards the end of Judges. But that just gives you kind of this glimpse into the land. Like, this is a terrible time in Israel's history, very terrible, very dark. And that darkness that's on display, it's going to be kind of this backdrop to kind of point our attention to something else, okay? And that's what we're going to see now as we talk about the theme of the book, all right, the theme of the book. So we'll talk about the theme, and then we'll take a break after that, okay? So theme of the book, we're going to go with the God who preserves his nation, the God who preserves his nation. The God who preserves this nation. And so we're going to see in the book of Judges the reality that God is working to preserve the nation of Israel. But this preserving has a purpose. Okay, it has a purpose. And the major point in Judges as to why God is preserving the nation of Israel is so that they can get a king. Right? So they can get a king. And so, again, this is tying into like our study of the Torah. All that where we saw the promise of a seed who would come and make all things right. He would restore man's relationship with God and get us back to Eden. And we started to see that fleshed out more through, it'd be like through the line of Abraham. Then it'd be through like the line of Judah. And even in that Genesis 49, he would be a king. So you see that element of a king. We're looking forward to this individual to come. And we had that heavy emphasis. But then if you noticed in the Torah, even like there's a shift to like, okay, but then it's also going to come from a certain nation. And so there's a shift to focusing on the nation, or is in the establishing of that nation that would have this international impact, right? Like getting all that. But now that the nation has been established in the land, like we just saw in Joshua, now we're turning the attention back to that individual, right? Does that make sense? We're again turning back to this king who is to come, okay? And so history is trending towards, right? Getting this person, the king of Genesis 49, the seed of Genesis 3:15, that will make all things right. And so we're going to see kind of two parts of this preservation, right, in Judges. So one, God is preserving Israel, like, to get a king. First off, they have to remain a nation so they can have a king, right? So they're preserving to get a king. But also what you're going to see is that in Judges, God is going to show that they need a king. Okay, not only are they showing, like, not only preserving them so that they get a king, but he's also going to show them that they need one. Okay, that they need one. And just how this connects to the book. So as we'll talk about in a second, you can divide Judges into kind of three main parts. That's going to be our outline in a second here. Three main parts. And so in the first part, we're going to see that all that Joshua warned Israel about kind of comes true. And that produces a crisis. All right, produces a crisis. And then the second part focuses on those actual judges we talked about. And this shows in the time of the judges that you have a crisis of leadership. Okay, you have a crisis of leadership. And so most of the judges are not good guys. Okay, they're not good guys. And so what you really need is what? A king. Okay, you need a king. And then the third and final part of the book, you see the crisis is not just in the leadership, but it's also in Israel itself as a nation. Okay, and that they are, as a nation, evil, and so you need a king, okay? That's what we're going to see. And this is all evidenced, right, by that repeated phrase throughout the book, what, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. So their wickedness is tied into the lack of a king. And so you're looking forward to a king, okay? But you need the right one, all right? You need the right king. And so kind of taking that a step further, like we ended Joshua on the note, like there's this kind of fracturing between the East and West, okay, that's already starting to develop. But then what we're going to see emphasized, and we'll talk about it tonight a little bit, is that with these various judges, these deliverers, most of the time, as I mentioned before, like they are not strong enough to unite the whole nation, okay? They can only get like certain tribes to follow. Not all the tribes rally behind them, okay? They can't unite it. And then, like, you continue forward in Israel's history. You have, like, Saul and David, like, King Saul, King David, and even Solomon. But then you remember what happens after Solomon? What happens to the kingdom? Divides, right? Splits back, right? And so what you, again, begin to see, right, is that the true king of Israel can unite all the tribes together. That's the true king. And so you not only need a king, you need the right king. Okay, the king of Genesis 49:10, the king of Genesis 3:15. Right, and so all this is deliberately moving towards Christ. Okay, that's what's going on. Okay, and then you have your structure of the book there again, those three parts where we see the crisis begins, then we see the crisis of leadership, and then the crisis of Israel itself. Okay, that takes us into the book of Judges, but we'll take a little 5-minute break here, come up for air, all that. Okay.